Are you going paperless too?
If I might have your attention, we'll call the Subcommittee on Healthcare Reform to order. What we have today is we have a work session scheduled for Senate Bill 96. We understand that there is a person, Martin Pittioni, that's here that would like to testify on that, and possibly as well as Sean Comer. And then we'll have an informational hearing on the Oregon Health Authority and the exchange. So with that, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 96. And Martin, if you'd like to come forward, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Morris, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Martin Pittioni. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Licensed Social Workers, and I appreciate the brief opportunity to come up here during work session on Senate Bill 96. As you may recall, when this bill was heard initially, there were no other boards present during the initial hearing on the bill, and quite frankly, I wanted to make sure that I have clearing from the governor's office before I show up here. And basically what I would like to convey to you very briefly is the Board of Licensed Social Workers is neutral on this bill. We have had a number of conversations among boards about this bill. There is no one who disagrees with the policy aspect of this bill. Everybody knows we have to get good data on our healthcare workforce, and the boards are all prepared to step up to the plate. Certainly my board is happy to step up to the plate and go through whatever data gathering and furnishing and cost, whatever that entails. The reason I wanted to briefly raise a flag for this committee, and I'm happy to hear that it apparently is up for consideration to go on to Ways and Means, is because there is a little bit of an issue on the funding end of the equation. And just for clarification here, when there was discussion about this bill during the hearing, I don't think that there really was full clarity regarding what is happening on the cost end of the equation. The way this program is currently being implemented is that the boards are being assessed a fee per licensee by the health authority. That cost is not to offset the board's costs of furnishing the data. That cost is here to actually fund the research end of the equation, which is basically, from my understanding is, the research that is being charged to OHA by their contractors for actually doing the analysis on the data that's being supplied by the board. So the boards are basically being hit two ways. One, we absorb our own costs for complying with Senate Bill 96, and in addition, we're also paying a fee to actually fund the research on that end. And the reason I was authorized to raise a flag is that may not be the very most efficient way to actually fund this research, because basically what it means is you have multiple boards that will have to go through a fee assessment process in order to fund a single entity's work. And our hope was to get an opportunity in Ways and Means to have a conversation whether there is a better way to approach the funding end of the bill. And with that, I just want to make sure that the committee is clear. We don't want to slow this bill down. We are collaborating with OHA. We're working with them. And I will shortly have a conversation with the governor's office about are there ways for us to do this better. And we're happy for this bill to move on and figure this out in Ways and Means.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the testimony, who was the testimony from the health authority, I wanted to cite one thing. It says, the bill does not specify when each new board must begin to submit data. Instead, OOPR, Oregon Health Policy Research, and the boards will collaborate on mutually agreed schedules that take both policy priorities and licensing board readiness into account. So I think your issues will be dealt with at that, because we know that I feel that the data is extremely important. The only way we can understand the workforce issues and be able to direct a policy, good policy, is to have data, and you are certainly a part of the healthcare arena. And so just be glad that your name was listed as a partner. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you. Anybody else with questions or comments?
Thank you.
You referenced a fee. Do you have any sense of what that fee would be, or has it gotten that far?
I think the question is best directed to OHA, because that's where I'm getting my information from in terms of how it currently works. But my understanding is that the current fee that's being used is $5 per licensee. And that is also, quite frankly, what informed. We were asked by Legislative Fiscal to put in a fiscal impact statement on this bill, and that was a big part of what certainly the fiscal of this board and probably other boards was based on, is if I have to pay, you know, $5 per licensee per year, then that is a pretty substantial impact on this board. For us, it will be about, roughly the overall impact will be about 17% of my total SNS budget for the next biennium if it starts up this next biennium. So it's a pretty big deal. For some boards, it's not as big of a deal that have higher licensing fees. If I think about, you know, I come from a board that has a very, very fee-sensitive licensee base. Social workers don't tend to be very highly paid. I have clinical social work associates. Those are the poorest of my licensees. If I have a $60, which is what it's currently at, annual fee, and I tag on $5 for them, that's an 8% increase in their fees. So for others, you know, it may not be as big of a deal, but for some of my licensees, it is a bigger deal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Morse, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Colmer, Deputy Administrator, Office of Health Policy and Research. The fees that Martin are referring to are calculated based on the limitation that we got in 2009 to run the program and will go down as the pool gets bigger. So it's really the total cost of the program and then who we add in, then the pool goes down. Whether the pool is going to be big enough to drop it from $5 to $3, we don't quite know because of what Senator Mona Anderson was referring to earlier about phasing in boards and figuring out who's ready and what you all and other policymakers see are the boards that we really need to talk to first.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Any other comments or questions?
Yes,
Senator Cruz.
So you won't start collecting fees from boards until you start collecting data? I mean, what? And that's the thing as of right now?
Chair Moore, Senator Cruz, that's currently how we operate.
Okay.
We currently have data from the 7 licensing boards from 2009,
right.
And we're just now starting to collect that the financials from that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 96 to Ways and... I forgot the language.
To the committee.
Move to
the... Gotta go back to committee.
The health policy.
It's coming to you.
It's got to come to my committee. This is all the first bill that's coming to my committee from here. Okay. Refer this committee back to the main health policy. Health, human services, and rural health policy committee.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Morris Anderson, who has moved Senate Bill 96 to the Senate Committee on Healthcare, Human Services, and Rural Health Policy. I would point out to members that as a subcommittee, we do not need fiscal policy or fiscal impacts or revenue impacts to move the bill back to the parent committee. So we're doing this.
But I will, right?
But you will. Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I think maybe a ruling on that, if the bill is going to Ways and Means, does it need to have fiscal before it goes there? Because that will, it still does.
Out of the full committee, but not from the
subcommittee. Even if it's going to Ways and Means?
Correct. According to the Senate President's office earlier this afternoon.
That sounds a bit duplicative, but...
We'll get a head start on it that way.
Well, it does, because they're going to probably change the stuff once it's down there, so, okay.
Conceivable that we could have a bill that has such a huge fiscal impact. The policy committee says they won't pick it up later.
That's a good point.
Have that information. Yeah. Any other comments, discussion? Objections? Hearing none. Clerk, please call the roll.
Senator Bates?
Aye.
Senator Lawrence Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Morris?
Aye. Motion carried.
Do you want to welcome Representative Ringer?
Yes. Representing the House today. Yeah. We welcome our House colleague.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming.
We've met him.
Welcome. Representative Widener, we're pleased that you're with us. And you're
I must say, I looked in the door down here, and it's like, am I the only House member that was supposed to be in this? I had to run back upstairs and check to make sure I was in the right place. So.
No, you're in the right place. We will open an informational hearing on the Health Insurance Exchange, and Dr. Bruce Kohlberg, Nora Leibowitz, and Rocky King, if you would come forward, please.
Chair Morris, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Kohlberg, the Director of the Department of Human Services and the Director Designee of the Oregon Health Authority, and we've got a great team here today. We're gonna take a team approach and hopefully have more of a conversation with you about the exchange. For the good representative, this is the, I believe, this the second time he's heard this. You know, we have an axiom in medicine. It's how we train doctors. It's called do one, see one, teach one. And so it's actually see one, do one, teach one.
There you go.
So after one more time, and we're going to have you give the presentation. That's okay.
Or you can leave.
Well, that was the other.
I'm going to. I think after this time, I'm just going to avoid it.
So. But we're going to try and have this be conversational. We're going to break up some of the responsibilities. I'm going to provide a brief introduction. Nora's going to walk through some of the nuts and bolts about the insurance exchange, and Rocky's going to do the real work, which is as questions come up, kind of field them, and I think we'll take things a step at a time. We've been, you know, it's really interesting when you look at this whole notion of insurance exchanges. We've been on a path of insurance exchanges here in Oregon since 2007. And in 2007, we had the Oregon Health Policy Commission, which I believe Senator Cruz was a member of, and Senator Bates recommended an insurance exchange as a central forum for individuals and small businesses to buy health insurance. We then had the Oregon Health Fund Board in 2008. One of their recommendations was to have an insurance exchange. They held a series of public meetings. In 2009, we had House Bill 2009 form the Oregon Health Authority and charge us with coming up with a plan and a business plan for an insurance exchange, and we've held community meetings around the state, gotten input from hundreds of people in a variety of formats, and are coming forward with plans for a health insurance exchange. And then, as I sort of point out, after all of that, finally at some point the federal government saw the light that clearly we'd been talking about here in Oregon. And certainly a big piece of health reform has been the insurance exchanges, which, you know, in the end comes down as a choice for states. Either through federal health reform, there's either an option for states to put together their own exchange, or if not, the federal government will do that for states, and people within states will actually have to go through the federal exchange. We clearly think that we can, A, do a better job here in Oregon doing that, and B, it would make a whole lot more sense if, as a state, we put together an insurance exchange which is really around the values and the healthcare system that we in Oregon want to have. So it's really with that we are entering into this exchange conversation. We started it Years ago, we've been working through the Health Policy Board on a number of ideas which have been vetted publicly. The board's taken all sorts of testimony. There, you know, 9 citizens who have really spent a lot of time debating a number of aspects of this bill and of the plans for an exchange. And that's really what we come before you today with is here's what exchanges are, and here's some draft thinking on what a group of people have been doing for the last year, and actually predating that over the last several years, on what and how an insurance exchange could look like and function with here in Oregon. So with that, I'm going to turn things over to Nora to sort of start with what's an exchange and then how we're going to put this together.
So recognizing, as Bruce did, that that you all have heard this in various forms, you know, probably collectively about 400 times.
It'll probably take 401 times.
Well, this is, yeah, right, this is the time. I'm going to try to go quickly, but feel free to, whatever the, where I'm not being clear, I'm always happy to explain more, because like Rocky, I like to talk. So thinking about what is a health insurance exchange, and we were talking about it as a marketplace, and I've sort of started to talk about it more as a health insurance store, based on the idea that the metaphor is really one place for people to go to figure out what kind of assistance they're able to get purchasing health insurance, what are their options for coverage, and to quickly and easily enroll in coverage, sort of that the one store that you'd go to. And in addition to sort of the centerpiece of it being a web-accessible place, that it's also a place people could get assistance by phone, in person, using insurance agents, using these community-based assistance providers. And really, it is, the idea behind it is that right now, even for people really educated in healthcare and health insurance, it can be really complicated and difficult to compare plans on an apples-to-apples basis. And this is really intended to make that kind of comparison possible. Just wanted to note, since many, this will be, affect a lot of Oregonians, for people making, families of 4 that make up to $88,000 a year, so 400% of federal poverty, they'll be able to access premium tax credits that'll help them pay for insurance. And as a note, the design and implementation costs through 2014 are federally funded, so there's not a general fund. This is not a general fund funded operation.
Excuse me just a minute to sure. Visit that. We're talking about funds yet to be appropriated by Congress. And in the event that those funds are not appropriated, what would be...
No, they got these.
A lot. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
So, Chair Morse, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the Interim Director of Healthcare Purchasing for the State of Oregon. And first of all, they have appropriated, I believe, the funding for the planning and the implementation design. The issue is going to be, of course, coming forward in 2014, whether the subsidy dollars are going to be there, given all the budget, you know, challenges they have at the federal level. But from now through... pushing the button for implementation, we've been told that the money's there to move forward with planning and actually designing and beginning the implementation process.
And that was $34 million approximately, or somewhere in that range?
No. Chair Morse, the first year of plan, the first planning grant was $1 million, but we are waiting, hopefully next Tuesday, to find out that we got a for the IT component of the development costs, a grant for $55 million, and that's just the IT piece. So it's significantly more than a few million. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Once this thing's up and operational, how many FTE are you envisioning?
Chair Morse, Senator Cruz, I don't think we can answer that yet, because part of what the bill does that's going to be before you on this exchange is establish a public corporation who will really be looking at putting those operational pieces together. We have a planning grant. We have some folks that are going to be coming in here very shortly to help us over the next 3 or 4 months put the skeleton on that plan. But I believe until the board, the public corporation, if that's the direction the legislature decides to go, really sets out all the different tasks they want to do and the framework in more detail, we won't have a specific answer to that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Along those lines, I would expect the number of FTE would also be dependent on how many people enroll. As your enrollment grows or shrinks, it's going to have to make changes. And we should be able to look at those ratios and compare it to private insurers and get some idea if you're in the right area as far as concerned. And watch the percent of premium it costs.
Chair Morse, Senator Bates, just as a point of comparison, we've looked at a sort of similar scale operation in Massachusetts that that has, I believe, around 30 or 40 folks who work for the exchange, and that they contract for a number of functions, the processing functions and Medicaid, that kind of thing.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is going to be kind of an unusual corporation, so I'm going to ask some sort of questions that are sort of devil's advocate. What kind of oversight will the legislature have on this? You'll be reporting the legislature on it, or is it a corporation like OHSU that has limited oversight from the legislation?
No, we're going to get through some of those accountabilities in a moment.
Okay.
So we'll show you exactly where what's being envisioned and where the accountability is.
We can speed through some of the functions since those are fairly well known. And just briefly, those are providing information and assistance to consumers, certifying health plans to participate, working on exemptions for people who are exempt from the individual requirement to buy health insurance, and working with the federal partners. The Health Policy Board spent a significant amount of time thinking about the groups to whom the exchange is accountable. And the most obvious one clearly is the consumers, that the exchange needs to provide excellent service and value to its consumers so that they'll want to come to the exchange. And then as I sort of mentioned before, that we have a responsibility to taxpayers, that to the extent that we can help reduce the cost of coverage, this helps the people who are buying coverage, and it also has an impact for the federal government in terms of their funding of tax credits, and then obviously to all of us as taxpayers that are paying for that. Within the state, we're accountable, the exchange is accountable to the legislature and to the governor, and part of that is making sure that as an organization it's using smart purchasing, it's trying to leverage the opportunities that we see in the state for delivery system reform, payment reform, in order to reduce costs and improve quality for all Oregonians. And then real quickly, obviously, the exchange is a business that works with health plans and other service providers. We want to make sure that we're a good partner working with them so that they'll want to participate, and that will in turn be a benefit for consumers. And then obviously the federal government, with whom we'll work on the tax credit side.
Nora, maybe back up just a minute. The representation is that there will be lower premiums. Have you run the business model to support that conclusion? We're in an environment where if you actually had lower premiums, it would be, there'd be a lot of happy people.
Chair Morse, just off the top of my head, I would say lower than what you would have without it. That's probably more accurate than just say lower premiums, although, you know, there's going to be some efficiencies around the administrative side. We know that with an exchange, you get 350 to 400,000 people in there in that first year, both in the individual and the shop exchange, which is the small business exchange. There's going to be some savings there. The other piece, though, is how that that exchange really is integrated into the transformation of the delivery system. You can't just set an exchange out there and expect you're going to see big savings. You can't just take the complexity of our market and how to access it and transform some delivery and expect to see the big changes. But blending those two pieces together, that's where we think that we can see some bending of that cost curve, which is critical, I think, going forward over the next 3 or 4 years, not only for the state in terms of our budget through the Medicaid piece that we'll be using the exchange, but for small business and individuals. So I don't think anybody can tell you that we're going to have lower costs. I can tell you that's going to be the focus of everything that's put into place.
Bruce? Chair Morris, let me give you a couple of concrete examples in terms of how an exchange and actually aggregating purchasing can start to bend the cost curve and decrease the rate of growth. Two examples would be one, in a benefit package. We've been looking at a value-based benefit package that the Health Policy Board actually took some real-time, I think it was OEB, a year's worth of OEB claims data, and ran it through this new benefit package. And I believe it was an approximately 5% savings in cost. So certainly by creating a benefit package that looked at evidence-based services and that was something that could be implemented throughout a large market like the exchange, that can help do that. Another is the exchange as a smart purchaser. Certainly we've seen a lot of work recently. I've read the Oregonian today front page story about primary care medical homes, and a lot of work being done around the country that shows that primary care medical homes can help improve quality and in many ways begin to lower medical costs. One of the things that an exchange can do and an exchange board can do in qualifying plans is say, we want all plans to offer a primary care medical home and pay the appropriate way that we can support that as a long-term strategy of lowering cost. It might be that two or three levels, there's different levels of plans that you could buy, could require those, and a third or a fourth might not. But those are, I think, ways where the exchange as a smart purchaser can allow people choice, but begin to set that within some boundaries that create common quality standards, common administrative standards, common payment standards, which can help drive some of the costs down. And, you know, the extent is going to be, and I think the balance in all of this is going to be the extent to which you're going to want to have an array of choice and competition within the exchange marketplace. And I think the balance for an exchange board is going to find the balance between absolute unlimited choice and ability to balance unlimited choice with some degree of being able to provide a kind of a benefit package and move a marketplace to greater cost control and greater efficiency.
Thank you. Senator Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bruce, can you tell me how you see the exchange interacting with DCBS and insurance rate review in 2014?
Can let Rocky handle that, that's okay.
Senator Morris, Senator Shields. I'm looking crystal ball to 2014. First of all, in Oregon, rate review and the regulatory responsibility for that resides with the Department of Consumer Business Services. The way that it moving forward is that under federal law, any rate for or any premium rate charged for a benefit package in the exchange has to be the same rate charged outside of the exchange for the same for the same benefit package. So a lot of people have thought that the exchange will be able to negotiate rates down. Well, to the degree that we have contracting standards and quality standards that impacts those rates, that can be true, but they must be the same rates both inside and outside. So we look at the exchange as really having a partnership with DCBS in that rate review process. They're going to have to work with the board and the exchange staff, but the actual responsibility for that review and final approval of the rate will lie DCBS. With DCBS.
Philip, and in 2014, you're also going to have a big influx of people in the individual market, so in some respects, the rate review process will even be more important and pronounced than it is today, is it?
Senator Morris, Senator Shields, and the federal government has contemplated this because they have established in the federal law three risk adjustment mechanisms, two of which will be operated by the state, defined by the federal government, and one that will be operated by the federal government to help look at some of the stability or instability issues or the market structure as we bring all those new people in. Additionally, I think, and from a policy perspective, and we've said this, I think, number of times, the state may want to look at a fourth option, because what is defined by the feds is good for Mississippi and California and Wyoming and may not fit every little piece of our market and how it operates. So one of the things we may want to look at in 2012 and 13, when we know what the federal government has designed, is something that may be a fourth option that's Oregon-specific with the objective, again, of making sure we have a stable market as some of these changes come forward.
Can I make a final comment, Mr. Chair? So I just wanted to call the committee's attention to some work that we've been doing in the on the small business protection part of my General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee to bring some more sunshine into the health insurance rate review process so that small businesses can advocate for themselves in that, and it's not just a process that the important individual and small group consumers are just watching as spectators, that they could actively engage in that process to advocate for lower premiums.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Just for a second, could you kind of contrast, and just to make this clearer to us, contrast what look like right now for an employer of 15 people trying to buy health insurance, not 100 employees, what his or her rates would look like? What happens if one of those 15 employees has a really bad illness, what the rates look like the next year, or maybe they can't buy insurance next year, compared to what happened to that employer and his employees or her employees if this was actually up and running?
Senator Morris, Senator
Bates. That's what we face. That's the real world. Yeah. That's the real world out there.
So let's take Mary's Texaco, 15 employees. They're uninsured today. They decide to get insurance. It is very complicated. First of all, who do they call? Where do they go? Do they go to the phone book? They go to an insurance agent. What if that agent is only licensed with two carriers, not all five? Will they get all five comparisons? There's no apples to apples generally between carriers' plans, so a $500 deductible plan here and a $500 doesn't necessarily equate. So it's very confusing, but eventually they will land, either by calling a carrier directly or by working through an agent, and we'll pick a plan. Now, in the small group market, rates basically have a 3-to-1 rate band, so you are rated for that benefit package based on the census rate, as they kind of call it, don't want to be too technical here, of that group. So if you have a younger group, you're going to be towards the bottom. If you're an older group, you're going to be at the top. This is pooled in a common pool with all small group plans for that particular carrier. So if you have, for example, somebody who has a $3 million claim, it doesn't make any difference in terms of the rates to that particular group. It may for the entire group because it's spread through that. You can't, other than there's a small adjustment like 5% that you can rate on the basis of claims. But otherwise, it's guaranteed issue. Your claims are pooled with the entire small group market. Now, going forward, this gets a little bit more complicated because when we start talking about some of the choices employers have in an exchange environment, it's no longer trying to, I think, find your way through the maze, you will have in front of you the information to compare plans, to look at rates, and to make a decision which plan you want to land on. In addition, your employees will have the opportunity through a defined contribution to select plans that are greater value than the plan the employer selected by participating in the premiums for that additional cost. So it's going to give greater flexibility to both to the employer and to the employee under the exchange model.
Employers under the exchange model will be able to move to a defined contribution, give employees a much wider choice of plans, so that if you had a new employee coming in to work, they wouldn't have to take your plan. They would be able to continue their continuity of care, continue their relationship with their doctors. So for employees, they get portability and continuity. For the business person, greater choice for their employees. And now it's a defined contribution, and the ability to actually have a lot of the administrative back room function of dealing with all of that handled actually through the exchange. And then lastly, the exchange will be able to handle any kind of a tax credit that people are eligible for. So that's really, in essence, for moving forward, it will provide more choice, greater portability, and ability to for the employer to fix a contribution and have more a clearer sense of what their expenses for healthcare will be, and a diminished backroom office function. Would that be a fair summary?
Fair summary.
So a defined contribution would be before tax. The tax liability would accrue to the employee that received the defined contribution. The employer said, I'll give you the money, you go to the exchange and buy.
Mr. Chair, it is pre-tax. You set up a Section 125 plan within your company, and you're contributing X amount of dollars to that the employee then can purchase their health insurance through the exchange.
Pre-tax.
Okay,
thank you. Go ahead.
Skip that.
Here we go.
So we've talked some just now about small employer groups that can enter the exchange. There's also thinking about other employer groups. The law is set up where, as of 2017, larger groups above 100 can participate. We've heard the most obvious benefits that we've been talking about are about increased choice, as well as the tax credit for the smallest employers, and those benefits are most obvious for the smaller employers. But in discussions that we've been having with the business community, we actually have gotten a lot of really positive feedback about this idea of a defined contribution, and kind of for a lot of employers, even larger employers, getting out of that business piece of it and allowing the exchange to provide that back office function for them. So to an extent, at least, that a little bit took me by surprise. There's been quite a bit of positive response from the business community. We've talked some about enrollment by individuals, people who are Medicaid eligible, which is up to about a little more than $30,000 a year for a family of four. They can use the exchange to get to Medicaid, and for them it will be seamless. It will be the same process. It won't suddenly look different because of the Medicaid. The choices of health plans will be different, but it's not gonna be like, you know, somebody gets first class and somebody gets coach. And then for obviously individuals who are looking to use the federal subsidies for premiums, this is the way that people will get it. And then people who aren't eligible for financial assistance will also use it. And to make that appealing to people, that's where the sort of the good customer service and the making this a positive experience for people in terms of being able to make comparisons between plans and enroll easily really comes in. So I've sort of just talked about this slide in a way by saying for individual consumers, it really is about access to coverage. It's about making the process easy. It's about knowing that the plans that are offered are of value to people, that we're not just saying any old plan offering anything can be in, that really the qualified health plans are going to, that's going to be a sort of a mark of quality. So, and then for employer groups, a lot of this is the same, as well as what Rocky was talking about in terms of employee choice and reduced administrative burden for employers. Obviously, again, customer service, access to information.
Mr. Chair, I think it's really important here to point out that the Oregon Business Council has tagged this as one of their key objectives they want to see happening. They really see some value for both small and down the road large businesses, especially around taking, for small businesses, taking their, they're not in the business to go out and buy health insurance. They're not specialists at that. And to be able to have kind of that central function that employees can go to is something that they've long dreamed about, I guess we could say.
And then I'm not going to go through this again because Rocky did a great job of explaining about this, about the payments and the administrative function. We also want to talk a little bit about the importance that we see of working with the health plans, that really for this to succeed, the insurance carriers have to see the business opportunity here, and certainly they are enthusiastic for a number of reasons, including that there will be a lot of new Oregonians looking for insurance coverage, and they're certainly interested in being the insurer for the newly insured folks. And in addition, they, in some of our meetings with the carriers, they've really expressed that they like the idea of having the apples to apples comparison, because they think, you know, everybody thinks that their product is the best, and they want to be able to show that in ways that are really meaningful, and that we definitely are focused on the ways in which having the exchange can be an administrative assistance to the health plans as well as to the consumers. Really do need to make the administrative piece work for the carriers. We're still looking for federal guidance on some of the federal requirements for what is a qualified health plan before the exchange tries to make final determinations. But we really think that the sooner that we can be clear about what are the qualifications for participating in the exchange as a carrier, the better off we'll be. And so we're trying to work with the carriers starting now to have the conversations about participation and about how that will work for them.
Where do the agents and the brokers that are in the market today, where do they fit in this plan?
You want to talk about it?
Mr. Chair, I believe that they're going to continue the role, very similar role to they play today, except that I think they'll be more focused on helping people navigate through the exchange, or there's still going to be a market that's outside that exchange for businesses that, for example, are above 50, where the majority of people in Oregon are insured through large businesses, large employers. So that role will continue to be there. I can guarantee you that in Albany, somebody's going to knock on the door of an insurance agent, an individual who's going to say, help me get individual coverage, help me understand what these options are. So I believe that the compensations for whether it's an agent or community navigators is going to be there. And so I see their role going forward as critical. I've been in this business for a long time, and one of the things I have found is if you travel this state, the people that have the pulse on the local community in terms of the problems with getting insurance and their barriers, especially small businesses, are the agents. They're not the carriers in Portland. It's the people that live in the Albanys and the Rosebergs of the world that really have the relationships. Those will be critical for helping people get into the exchange.
If the product is priced the same inside the exchange and outside the exchange, how do you save money inside the exchange? Because you've covered the outside the exchange, you've covered in that premium, you've covered the broker fee and the agent cost and the servicing,
sure,
you know, that overhead. How does that work?
Senator Morris, just like it does today, if you have two people that buy insurance, one uses an exchange, the other doesn't, they're the same plan, same age, they pay the same price. Well, whoops, this person used an agent, where's that 2% or 5% or whatever it may be? they're the same price. Carriers don't price individual products to the individual based on an agent being used. That is spread across their entire book of business in terms of what they call retention or marketing costs. It'll be the same with an exchange. Those costs will be spread throughout the market. To the degree that fewer people use an agent, those costs will be reduced for the carrier as a whole. So it'll be the same prices. They spread those across.
Well, I know in the Internet business, purchasing over the Internet, you can fulfill that a whole lot cheaper than you can through a wholesaler and a retail point of sale. And I would envision in the exchange you have that function of an Internet transaction. But yet you don't have, I mean, your pricing is going to be the same. Somehow that doesn't...
Senator Morris,
real
use e-health insurance, for example. If you go through that and don't use an agent and buy product A from carrier A, and again, everything else being equal, you will pay that same price if you go to the carrier direct. Those retention or administrative marketing costs are spread generally through the market. Now, there are states where you can elect to use an agent or not use an agent. California has some experience with that. And it was interesting to find the number of people that used agents was a lot higher than what anybody thought, even though they knew they may pay 2% more per month because of that. We don't anticipate that we're going to have that. We would rather engage the agents in making sure we can get 375,000 people into this program as quickly as we can.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
One of the things when I talk to agents that they come up with often is they have a shrinking market. They can't sell policies anymore because they're too expensive. The premiums are too high, and they can't sell the product. So they got a market shrinking down no matter what happens here. And many of them are actually pretty excited about the exchange as one way to start bringing costs down so they still have a job. Now, they know we have to transform healthcare and bring those costs, or at least bend the curve if they can't bring it down directly. But I still think they have a role to play here, and if something doesn't change, they're not going to have a role to play at all because everyone's going to be in Medicare or Medicaid or be self-insured through a large corporation, and everybody else will be gone. And their market, for the most part, is that niche between the self-insureds, Medicare and Medicaid, and that's the market that we're seeing collapse.
Chair Morris, members of the committee, I think that we're seeing with the beginning discussions about health insurance exchanges everywhere around the state, the nation, that this whole market is evolving, and it's starting to evolve now. It's going to evolve over the next several years, and business models will start to change, how people buy health insurance, to be able to actually buy it very differently on the web. I think that the business model and the work of insurance agents will evolve as well. And I think no one wants to sit here today and be able to say, this is what it's going to look like in 2014, 15, or 16. But I think that, like any business, this will be something that evolves and that will hopefully evolve to a way where we continue to pay for the services that are delivered. I mean, you never want to not pay people for work that they do, but at the same time that we start to get better value for what we pay for. And that's likely to evolve. And there may be an evolving business model for insurance agents, and certainly much more of a market in which to actually have that business within. I mean, much as we're seeing businesses evolve across the globe, whether it's newspapers, whether it's bookstores, all sorts of things, and we'll hopefully see transitions that are orderly.
So thinking about the authorizing legislation for the exchange, seeing the exchange as a public corporation, and when we started to think about the public corporation, it came up that there's not actually one public corporation statute. So thinking that SAFE is a public corporation, the ports are a public corporation, OHSU, and they all differ a little bit in their statutory construction. Are
our goal for the public corporation is really to retain the transparency and the trust in government while having an organization that's nimble and can respond quickly to business needs. So the governing board would have three members who were serving by virtue of their other roles in the state, and that would be the director of the Oregon Health Authority, the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and the chair or designee of the Oregon Health Policy Board. Policy Board. There have now been so many boards. And the other six members would be governor-appointed and Senate-confirmed. And this group would have the authority to adopt rules and policies that are needed for the functioning of the exchange, and this includes establishing an assessment and collecting an assessment on carriers in order to fund the operating costs of the exchange on an ongoing basis. The legislation also includes a number of accountability measures, so we recognize that this was of good interest, and I appreciate your waiting until we got to this slide, because we have a whole list of them. And included in the legislation is that the statutory charter for the exchange is a consumer-oriented organization, and that would be expressed from, you know, starting at the level of a consumer-oriented mission statement and kind of flow down through the board and through the staff. That there would be a public appointment and confirmation process for the board members. There's a conflict of interest provision. We looked at California's conflict of interest language in their exchange legislation, and they had that no board members could have any financial relationship or regulatory or organizational relationship with insurance carriers, health insurance carriers, or medical providers or agents, et cetera. And the Health Policy Board spent a fair amount of time talking about this because there's an interest in making sure that this organization isn't run, that it's run for the benefit of consumers rather than for some other group. There was also the feeling that people who have relationships with the insurance industry or medical community have a lot of experience and knowledge that we may want to draw on. So the language is written so that of the six governor-appointed members, that no more than two of them could have this kind of relationship with an insurer or a medical provider. And that would also follow for the staff of the exchange, that they wouldn't have those relationships. And that we also have transparency provisions, including open board meetings, et cetera. And there would be stakeholder advisors, advisory groups, particularly individuals enrolled in the exchange and small businesses using the exchange, as well as advisors who were insurance carriers participating in the exchange, working with agents, working with others who are involved in this world as stakeholders. And then in addition, some ways of finding out how well the exchange is working for all of its consumers and carriers, et cetera. And then really we put in a number of measures for reporting, doing annual reporting to the legislature and to the governor, and including on the financial operations of the exchange and the administrative functions and kind of general information as well about the administrative functioning of the exchange. And this is really consistent with the requirements in federal law that there's particularly on the financial side, reporting to the federal government on these measures. So it really made a lot of sense to be doing the same thing at the state level.
Who does the navigator work for?
The navigator is paid by the exchange for the work that they do.
They're not employees of the exchange. They're people out in the community who will have a business as a navigator.
And we haven't really talked about whether that's on a grant basis or a per application basis. Or
the expectation is it is not a state employee.
No. No.
Chair Morris, members of the committee, give you an example. Right now, for the Healthy Kids program, I mean, part of the issue was to do outreach to communities and make people aware, bring them in, help them sign up for the Healthy Kids program. That's whether you call that a, you know, outreach, a navigator, et cetera. But there were grants given to community organizations. In the exchange, these could be individuals who will, in essence, help consumers navigate, understanding that not everybody can go to the web and choose a plan. Likewise, not everybody will want to go to an insurance agent. This is sort of another function which is actually specified and envisioned in federal law, but isn't an employee of the exchange. It allows for this role and for the exchange to determine how to use these individuals.
Could a navigator also be, or could an agent contract to be a navigator?
Yeah. Senator Morris,
yes.
They actually do under Healthy Kids today.
Okay.
There are agents who have chosen to.
They're
do
making
that.
It a little easier.
Yeah, it's a different for this Chair Morris. It's a different business model for the navigator. So we right now have agents who, in helping people sign up for Healthy Kids, in essence, the business model is they get paid for the service that they do in signing up the child, and it's a one-time fee for that service, which is a different business model than the ongoing commission of an insurance agent or broker. But we have insurance agents doing that navigator fees function, so to speak, and they can do both.
And we would definitely want both agents and navigators to engage with the exchange to do training about, you know, what are the options and how to best help people. So, and we've heard a lot of positive feedback about the way that the FIAT program engages agents in terms of doing training with them and making sure that they have all the information that they need and feel comfortable to represent the products. Some decisions that are yet to be made. The hope is that we're doing a lot of the work, including through doing this detailed operational planning over the next few months. And while the legislation is in process, that we're preparing for the exchange board to exist. Once the board is seated, there are a number of issues that they need to make some decisions on, and that really includes what are the benefit design options, what kind, you know, or what range of qualified health plans are going to be included in the exchange, how will the board make that decision? That a lot of that needs to be worked out by the board, as well as issues of market configuration. There's the issue of is the exchange an option in a so-called dual market where you could go inside or outside of the exchange? Does the exchange become the entire individual or small group market? How do we pay navigators? What's the role of agents? That kind of thing for consumer assistance, and then the details of how the exchange is funded so that it's self-sustaining starting in 2015.
Interrupt for a moment, Chair Morse, members of the committee. In essence, the Health Policy Board spent a year grappling with all these issues, and in the end came to the conclusion that there's, quite frankly, a lot of very complex business decisions to make about risk adjustment, markets, plans, navigators, consumers, and that continues to evolve. And so in the end, the vision of the exchange is that the legislature would establish really three things about the exchange. It would set up the exchange and its mission. It would provide for the governance, a board of directors, and the accountabilities that board would have. And then three, it would set up, give the exchange and that board the the necessary authorities to operate within the federal health reform law, which you have to have the authority to interface with the IRS and a variety of authorities that are necessary to carry out the functions of the exchange. After that, the whole notion is this needs to run as a business. It needs to be nimble. It needs to bring value. It needs to either sink or swim on its ability to provide value and be a business. And therefore, the whole notion was there's a lot of business decisions that need to be made, some of them very quickly, some of them more deliberately, and that was the whole notion besides setting up a board and to run this thing like a business. That's why it's a public corporation, not to be run as a state agency, but to be run outside of government with that ability to work nimbly, but at the same time to maintain that accountability. And so there's a lot of decisions to get made that are, some of them, extremely technical and complex, and the whole notion is let the exchange do that, and in the end, this has to be self-sustaining. It will self-sustain itself, so it will either bring value and run as a business and be able to bring that value to people, or it won't. And if it doesn't, it will not succeed. We believe it can. We believe with the right people and the right design, this can be a tremendous benefit. But in essence, I think that gives you a flavor for, after a whole year long of discussions about all of these things, these have to be business decisions. It was where the Health Policy Board came down on.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
When the board, the exchange board, goes through the benefit design, will there be a public process to that, or is this just decisions made by the exchange board? And I've heard good things and bad things about, say, PEB's design, how PEB's benefit, and then OEB's benefit, and the good and bad. So is there public input, or is this really exchange board's going to have the knowledge to, you know, we don't want designs that are so skinny that no one's going to want them.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, this is going to be an iterative process over the next few years. The federal government is going to basically lay out what is called the essential benefits that must be provided, and that's going to be related to both inside and outside these markets. Qualified health plans will be in the market. The board will then, or the exchange board, will have an opportunity to design those plans. It's envisioned that you'll have at least four levels. They call them metal plans, bronze, silver, gold, platinum, that basically all include all of the same benefits, but will have a difference in terms of the cost sharing that the enrollees must participate in. So it's though, and we have some companion bills that will be coming forward, one through DCBS, for example, that requires every carrier in the small group and individual market to offer at least two of those four plans, the bronze plan and what's called the silver plan. So that's going to be a very public process, both on a national level, as they move forward towards, I think, Nora, towards the end of this year and the first part of next year, they hope to have those laid out. And then I think it will be for the states to begin to look at how they want to and what leeway they have to play with those essential benefit packages. I mean, it's going to be very public.
Senator Cruz?
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things. First, Rocky, you're assuming a lot of things happening at the federal level that may or may not happen, number one. So to tie our boat totally to federal action may not be the best thing. Another just comment, pardon me if I have a fair amount of skepticism about government being able to run anything as a business, because historically government does a lousy job of running things as a business. But my question is, so the operational date of this is 14, right? Okay, and there's a lot of decisions to be made between now and then. so my question would be, why are you asking us? Wouldn't it make more sense for you to ask us to allow you to do steps 1, 2, 3, 4, come back in February and say, okay, now this is the rest of it? What do you think of that?
Chair Moore, Senator Cruz, members of the committee, this needs to be operational January 1, 2014, which means people can actually purchase coverage. Really means we have to be up and running really around July 1, 2013 to begin enrolling people so that they can get their coverage on January 1. In that two-year time frame, I think a lot of this really is about being able to start to put together the infrastructure to set up the eligibility and the interface both on the Medicaid side as well as with the IRS. We believe will take a two-year period. In fact, all of us as states that are looking at this are feeling as if that date, the summer of 2013, is rapidly approaching. And to set this up, to put together the electronic infrastructure, to make these decisions, to seat a board, to make these decisions, to begin to do this, that, quite frankly, we're going to be lucky to meet that. So in terms of the ability to get some of the federal funds to be able to do this, it means establishing an exchange, getting together a board, providing some governance of some sort, and providing for the authorities to put up the exchange. Certainly, I could envision coming back in February, next legislative session, and looking at and continuing to have the legislature provide some additional authorities or oversight to an exchange. But I think what we've put together is pretty much the minimum that would actually allow the state to begin to move forward. It doesn't preclude additional legislation or either additional authority or lack of authority, but this really begins the basic minimum to start to, A, meet the federal requirement, B, get the work done, and C, avail ourselves of the federal support to do it. If we don't start now, we would be unable to meet the federal deadline.
Follow up?
Yes.
I understand that, Bruce.
Yeah.
Okay. But I also know that once you create something in government, it lives forever. I believe right now this year is 2011, is it not? Okay. I thought that was the year we were in. What I'm suggesting... because I look at, we're going to do something, just give us the authority to do it and we'll go do it. What I'm suggesting is maybe we say, okay, we need to create this structure. And you have said there's a lot of meat you got to put on the bones
yeah.
here. There's no question about that. How about if we give you the skeleton and then next year we come back and if we like the stakes you have created, we barbecue.
Senator Moore...
Somebody has to be sacrificed to get this.
Yeah. Well, that's true.
Chair Moore, Senator Cruz, I think that's certainly a discussion that we can have. I see no... I think within the confines of A, what we need to do to get started from a federal perspective, and then looking at some sort of an iterative process. I think that's a conversation we could have. Exactly what that would look like, I don't know, but I think something that is certainly something we can work together to see if that would work. Although one point I would make, I don't see this, and I don't think the Health Policy Board has seen this as being something that's run by government. It actually is run by a board of directors. It's got its own financing. Doesn't come to the state for money. The startup costs are, in essence, capitalized by the federal government. So I really, you and I have had many discussions over the years about the role and function of government, and I think this exchange has actually very intentionally, there's some things government does well and some things government shouldn't do.
Right.
And the exchange hasn't been set up as government and or set up as something that would get some sort of an appropriation from whether it be the federal or the state government and then continually come back for that to be established. This is really being set up as a self-sustaining business model by a public corporation run by a board of directors that in the end will be successful or not. Now, I also understand your skepticism and the slippery slope and all of that. But and I just want to, I think that the vision is to set up something very different than perhaps what sometimes you think about.
Bruce, I understand that, but keep in mind from the perspective of the public, SAFE's government, okay, they don't see any difference. From the perspective of the public, and that's an important aspect of this. So,
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing I was wondering about is access to the exchanges from the carriers. Certain carriers, are more hospitable to providers, to their consumers. Certain carriers, it's very, very difficult to get a human being to talk to on the phone. In payment practices, there are certain carriers that will fish for months for pre-existing conditions to avoid making payments. So I was just wondering how a carrier's behavior might impact their ability to be in the exchange or not be in the exchange and how that might proceed.
Chair Morse, Senator Shields, members of the committee, I think that's going to be the role of the board to monitor quality, to qualify plans that will meet certain standards. So I can envision if indeed, certainly, I'll go back to my primary care home example. If the vision is to want to have plans that provide primary care homes, part of what the board may want to do is assure that those primary care homes are paid appropriately. So I think that there's going to be quality standards that I would hope that we envision that the exchange would do, looking at consumer satisfaction, things like you indicated, that you can talk to an individual on the telephone. Those are all going to be roles of the board. And I think the balance of the board is going to be the balance between, A, assuring that quality. That's going to be one piece. B is going to be price. And C is going to be choice. And all of those create the kind of balance that you want to find the right balance. You don't want to have just one plan, as Senator Monis Anderson mentioned. You want to have some choice at the same time and have plans compete. At the same time, you don't want that choice to be plans that don't meet a quality standard. So that's what this board is going to do, is qualify plans, and hopefully, as Nora indicated, we're going to create a marketplace where there's going to be competition for all those things, plans who will compete for more and more and more and better quality, to compete for price, and have that be part of the exchange. So I think that this can work. And that really, what you described, I mean, all those functions are going to be ways that the board will, we hope, look at what plans qualify. Not going to want to qualify plans without quality.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, yeah, I think as you look at that, there needs to be some process for disbarment.
Yeah.
Through and have the public very much involved in their ability to make, you know, their experiences known to the board in ways beyond just, you know, sending me an email or setting up a website or.
And Chair Moore, Senator Shields, that's very much consistent with the vision, both in terms of the initial qualification of health plans to participate, but also recognizing that it's not a one-time. Okay, you met the qualifications now, you look good now, but what happens in a couple of years if things change? But it's intended that this is an ongoing assessment, that plans will be rated on a on an ongoing basis, and that'll include consumer satisfaction, that'll include direct interaction with the exchange, as well as asking for part of the assessment to be what are the complaints at the. Do they have a way of tracking complaints? What kinds of complaints they get? What are their satisfaction ratings? Working with our consumer advisors, using a number of methods to get a sense of the consumer's ability to utilize the plans and their satisfaction with them.
Thanks.
I would hope that the PEB experience would be a little bit instructive. What you might have so many onerous qualifications and restrictions that carriers decide not to be in the exchange. And if that happens, the exchange would collapse. So there's a kind of a regulating function there that hopefully would work. So it's a balance.
That's exactly it.
In fact, there are reasons why there are some carriers not providing service through PEB today. So
it was one of the big lessons in the Massachusetts exchange, where they set out some criteria and then they realized they actually needed to go out and solicit more choice and more plans.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes.
If I may apologize to Dr. Goldberg, but my staff heard him say that I might have to give this presentation, and they knew that wouldn't be good, so they went and scheduled a couple appointments for me. So.
Smart staff.
We have more faith in you than they do.
Well, they know how much I love the exchange so far, so they thought it would be better if I didn't do it on your behalf.
Yeah. Well, are we about done?
Yes, the other information is really about the timelines, and Bruce has really talked through that.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions?
There will be, but not at the moment.
Okay. We have a draft, and we have a bill. Can you explain the relationship between the two? We have an LC draft,
yes.
And we have a bill. Is this an amendment, a new bill, or a...
Chair Morris, given the timing of the bill drafting and the work that the Health Policy Committee was doing, or Health Policy Board was doing to make its recommendations, it was really just a timing issue where the first iteration of recommendations went into the bill, and then particularly on the accountability measures, that was a big discussion that happened in November and December, and so it sort of missed the drafting deadlines, and this is an attempt to include those recommendations in those areas.
The LC 3732 will be the guiding document?
Correct.
Right.
Not Senate Bill 99. That will be amended.
That's an amendment, not a new bill?
It's going to be both.
It will be both.
I'm confused. What happens to 99?
That will be amended. And I believe that there are some legislators that are looking at creating a similar bill. We'll have two of the same vehicles.
They should look. It looks look the same for both sides. The idea is to get a clean bill out without a lot of slashes and overlays to it. To really get,
I like that, by the way.
Getting a nice clean one to start with, and as clean as we can get it, and it's hopefully it'll be acceptable. But if it's not, at least we start with something fairly clean to really go through line by line, without having to say, oh, this LC is on top of that, this LC is on top of that, this, you know, this amendment number 23 here. We're trying to avoid that.
Is this LC the clean one?
Yes.
Yes.
So that's going to be
that's
a new bill.
That's the place to start, exactly.
That's going to be a new bill, be dropped with a whole new number on it. Mm-hmm. So what happens to 99 at that point?
My understanding was it's a stuff and gut, isn't it?
Yes.
It's a stuff and gut.
So this is going to be 99.
Going to be.
So it's a stuff and gut. So it will be dash one is what we'll be working with. Stuff
no,
and gut
it hasn't
stuff.
Been dropped yet.
It hasn't been dropped yet, so you'll see.
Oh, wait, 99 has been dropped.
If 99's in there, if that goes in.
That's going to be amended into 99.
Yes.
Okay, then that's an amendment, so it's not a new bill.
Well, no, but it's clean. You'll be looking at.
But it's a gut and stuff, but it's right. 99 phase two, correct?
Right.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. That.
We wanted it.
That took a long time to get there, Bruce.
Well, we wanted it.
Can it become more efficient?
As clean as we can get when you first see it. So I'll leave it that way.
Well, that allows us then to actually enter into subsidy discussions on the bill
right.
Next week. If this is a dash one, so we will schedule this, and hopefully DCBS will. Have whatever that moving target is in conforming to the federal regulations, have their bills ready at some point in time. So our task is DCBS and the exchange, and then whatever other bill may emerge with respect to financing options.
Is that draft going to be available to other folks?
What have you done with this draft? Is that
available to the public yet? We're getting.
Well, I'm thinking about just a few of the public, which would be us. But
yeah, I haven't even read it yet. It just came out today.
Okay, well,
it
today.
Just dropped on our desk.
Yeah,
today.
We haven't even.
Ago. So, I will make copies for the.
Okay.
For the committee then, or do you want to wait and go through the
go forth.
Machinery?
Go forth.
Well, go forth. Okay.
I would suggest
that your eyes on it, the better off we're going
to
be.
I mean, LC's got it drafted as an LC draft. They need to read. They need to do the title page again and make it a dash one too.
Okay. We haven't even read it, so
okay.
That's
okay.
I think why it's just a draft.
Okay. We will await the dash ones.
I assume that the LC is the one I've been looking at with you,
yes.
Line by line, cleaning it up and making it as clear as we can.
Yes.
So I haven't seen that particular final print either, but it's the one we've been working on. We're trying to get something to you, a product to you that's not got a lot of stuff laid into it, as clean as possible, and that's the one we have to work on.
To have that available for weekend reading might be
absolutely.
Nice. Okay.
I think I'm reading it now, too.
Okay.
Make sure what we change is properly changed. There were typos or other issues. I mean, there were some things that just weren't right in it, and I'm hoping this is clear enough that it can really start a good discussion.
One thing that in our discussions previous, we had talked about isolating and highlighting what is federal and what is Oregon,
mm-hmm.
And that would be very helpful.
Very helpful.
Because we all understand the requirements, at least as we know it today, the federal government has made. And if we know what those are, it will help us move the bill and understand it, I think, more clearly.
Chair Morris, members of the committee, I was going to let Nora know about our discussion. So thank you for having done that. We will do that. We'll create... we'll figure out some way to highlight exactly which are the parts that absolutely are a federal requirement and what isn't. I think that'd be really helpful.
Would be.
I have a staff person who the very mention of the word spreadsheet, he gets very excited. So I'm sure he's. I'm glad we have people like that.
Is he for hire?
Okay.
Loan.
Is there anything else for the good of the order this day?
And I would, the one thing I did want to tell people to remember in an overarching way, as you read through this, remember if we don't do it, they will.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't like this or like the idea of doing this, think what it'll be like if the feds come in.
Well, I don't even like them doing the essential benefit package. Mm-hmm. That bothers me mm-hmm. mentally.
Chair Morris, members of the committee, that's actually been a concern of ours.
Mm-hmm.
And we've already begun some preliminary discussions with HHS and let them know. In fact, I had a meeting with Secretary Sebelius during the summer, and one of the issues that came up was exactly this, that we fully expect that we will go to the Secretary and request a waiver on a benefit package.
Make a deal with them. If we get the rest of the state's Medicare, Medicaid rates, we'll let them do the essential benefit package.
I think we're going to make you a member of our negotiating team.
So Bruce, you're thinking we don't necessarily need to be tied to the list or to the Medicaid benefit package at this point. Good.
No. Senator Cruz, members of the committee, the federal legislation says that the Secretary of Health and Human Services will define an essential benefit package for the exchange. And that's the floor. What we also expect that's going to be probably much more of a traditional type of a benefit design than perhaps some of the value-based designs and other things that we've kind of looked at here in Oregon, and that we're likely to want to go to the Secretary and get a waiver for a benefit package that makes sense for us as a state.
And she certainly was given that authority in the legislation.
Exactly.
As well.
Okay. Any comments? Welcome.
Now, could you?
Hopefully you and your colleagues will join us in the future when we get into this and stay with us on it.
I just got with my staff, and my calendar is cleared for every Thursday, so I can get double takes of Dr. Goldberg all the time. I found him so incredible the first time.
Well, okay. Representative Widener, it actually takes you three times to actually grasp it, but that's a
lot. No.
It might take more
We're
than
deteriorating.
That.
You're close.